EWO, we could actually see the Marines landing, the Dedham, the ships coming in like that, and their flap ramps coming out like that, and the Marines going right onto the beach and stuff. And it was.
I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes, a podcast dedicated to honoring the brave men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Each Tuesday, I'll sit down with an incredible military hero. We will listen to unedited, authentic stories in their own voices, in their own words. We will hear incredible military stories from some of the greatest heroes to ever walk the face of this earth. And who knows, we may even learn a few of their secret life lessons along the way. Although none of us can begin to imagine what they've seen, heard, and experienced, during our time together, I'll do my very best to take us all for a walk among heroes. Here we go. I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast episode 26A with Mr. Bill Lozano, United States Navy. We haven't had a member of the Navy on the podcast here in a little while. We've had some Air Corps guys, some Army guys, so thought it would be a good time to feature this incredible man's story. Mr. Lozano, who resides in San Antonio, Texas, he was part of the USS Washington, and he was a radar man for the USS Washington, and that was radar technology at that time was brand new, and it was a revolutionary type technology, and Mr. Lozano was sent to training course to learn radar, and he was stationed in the radar tower on the ship. So he had a bird's eye view, not only of, you know, everything that happened on radar, but also he saw everything that was happening around the ship. And he was, for the most part, his group, they were responsible for alerting the captain and the bridge of any type of attack that was coming. Of course, they'd usually see it on radar first, and then they would see it with their naked eye. But it was a critically important job at a time where radar technology was brand new. And so the mission of the USS Washington, which was first launched in 1940, and then it was commissioned in 1941 and decommissioned in 1947, and had an incredible, impeccable battle record. And for Mr. Lozano's time on the ship, and for the majority of World War II, the ship operated in the Pacific and provided screening and support for the aircraft carrier groups, which is obviously a critically important job because those aircraft carriers were literally mobile weapons of destruction. And of course, the Japanese wanted to desperately to destroy those. So there were several layers of protection in these fleets, and the battleships were the next, the final line of protection. As the Japanese would fly in and try to bomb and try to kamikaze these aircraft carriers, the battleships were sort of the final line of protection up to the aircraft carrier itself. And then in front of the battleships, you had the cruisers and the destroyers. So Mr. Lozano was on the radar tower, seeing all of these planes flying in and then alerting the bridge and telling them, you know, what was happening. In addition to providing screening and protection for the aircraft carriers, the USS Washington participated in providing fire support for most of the primary invasions that you've heard of, you know, during World War II. You've probably heard of, you know, all the major battles like Guadalcanal, the Marianas, the Philippines, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, all of those battles, the USS Washington was involved in providing close support. And then for Iwo Jima, specifically, and Mr. Lozano goes into detail on this, but he could literally see he was close enough to shore, the battleship was close enough to shore to see the men landing on the beach and being shot, and it was just brutal stuff. But what's so unique about Mr. Lozano is he had a perspective of the war that very few people had. You know, many times when you talk to anybody in the Navy that was on the ships, they didn't see anything. You know, these ships are floating cities. There are thousands of sailors on these ships. Literally, there's a crew of, I think a peacetime crew is about 1,800. And during World War II, there were more than 2,000 on the USS Washington, on this specific battleship. And so these things are like floating cities, and usually the average person has no idea what's actually happening or where they're at. But because Mr. Lozano was in that radar tower, he saw everything that was happening. And so he saw it from a very strategic position. So very interesting story. This is a two-part episode. We're back to a two-part episode. Part one, as we launch into the conversation with Mr. Lozano, we're going to pick it up. He's showing me several pictures. And so he has a photo album, showed me several pictures. And so I just wanted to highlight a few. Obviously, you can't see the pictures in the podcast, but there's a couple of really cool stories that went along with that. So I wanted to pick a few of those I put there. So when we joined Mr. Lozano, we're looking at his photo album and going through that. And then episode one will contain much of his military service. He'll talk about, you know, sort of when he went into the military and what the mission of the USS Washington was. He'll recount several battles. And then episode two, we'll also talk about his military service, but we'll go backwards chronologically and talk about his childhood and those sorts of things. So just very, very interesting, simply an amazing man. After he left the military, he went into law and became an attorney and just had a very, very successful career. He lost his wife last year, which was just, you know, devastating. They'd been together for a very long time. And so I want to thank Mr. Lozano for coming on. I hope you really enjoy his story. Please share it with your friends if you enjoy it. You can find everything, all the podcast episodes on www.walkamongheroes.org or wherever you listen to podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, all those places. So thank you so much. And without further ado, here's Mr. Lozano.
Working for Piggly Wiggly.
Piggly Wiggly.
It was a little grocery store.
Oh, I know Piggly Wiggly.
And it was sort of a one-man or two-man operation. And there was a manager who, he looked to me like he was about 100 years old, but he's probably about 50 at the time. And what was happening was that I would go in the morning before school, and he'd get together with his bunch and go get some change and get coffee and come back to the store and stay there by himself during the week.
Yeah.
But it wasn't much business or anything. And then after school, I would stop in and work for a couple more hours there and do that. And he wanted me to continue doing that until I was drafted. And because I wanted to get into the Navy.
Sure.
Because my other buddies that I had went into the Navy.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure I got into the Navy, and I wasn't going to be sure if I got drafted. So I was real hesitant about it. But I did do it. But hell, it was only, like I said, I graduated from school in June. It was from June to October when I did this. And then in October, as soon as I turned 18, I got a notice to appear. And the odd part about it was my uncle was on the draft board. And so, yeah.
So this was your notice to report.
Yeah.
November 26, 1943. Report at the transit tower at 8 a.m. on the 22nd day of December, 1943.
This little one here, he sort of looked after me because he was probably 3 or 4 years older than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in, I was just turned 18.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the Navy did for me, it made me grow up. I mean, I was a kid when I went in, and you know, you become a man after a while and stuff. And he was from, I think maybe from North Carolina. And his name was John Meesmer. And he and I would go on Liberty together. And he sort of took a shine to me when I first went into aboard the Washington.
Yeah. Imperial Domain of the Golden Dragon. This is to certify that Mr. Lozano has been duly initiated, inducted in the silent mysteries of the Far East, having crossed the
80th meridian in the year of 1945 in latitude 1540-00, longitude 180-00-00 on board the USS Washington. And then you have another one here for the domain of Neptunus Rex, ruling of the raging main. And that you've crossed another longitude, latitude. That's so fun. So each one, each time you crossed a certain area, they would do these things to. How neat is that? How many people, how many total people were on that vessel?
My estimate was between 2,000 and 2,500 were on the ship. But we even had I call it a detachment of Marines on the ship, because at that time, the Marines were part of the Navy.
Right.
I mean, just like at that time, the Air Force was part of the Army.
I just say, we weren't old enough to drink or anything, but when we went over, we stopped at Honolulu.
Right.
I mean, and coming back, we stopped at Honolulu. And this person over here, his name was Oscar Mazzi, and we were both interested in the law, and
he was from Houston, Texas, and he ultimately became a justice of the Texas Supreme Court.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did you stay in touch all those years, or did you just catch the name later on?
You know, after we got back, we didn't talk about anything because we were too busy. I mean, I was too busy going to school, and I assumed he was too busy going to school. And I didn't know anything about reunions, because what happened was I was living with my folks when I went in on Woodlawn.
Yeah.
And they moved away from Woodlawn, and the forwarding address was their names.
Yeah.
My name was never listed on it as a forwarding address. So the reunion committee lost sight of me. Mm. And then it was one time they were going to have a reunion, and Oscar called me and said they were going to have one in Louisiana. And I said, well, that sounds good. And he told me about it. So I signed up for it. And I went to about four of them.
Yeah,
because they had them on the East Coast that I didn't go to, and Louisiana in the middle part, mm-hmm. and on the West Coast they'd have it they were having them in Reno.
Oh, I see.
And so we'd do that.
Well, that's wonderful that you could.
And. This is at one of the reunions where there were sort of the last of the Mohicans from, we were in what they call the I Division. Everybody here was on our ship at one time. This last one got on it later. But like I said, this is the same little fellow, John Miesmer, that sort of took care of me. And this fellow here was in with we called it the mafia in our group. There was an Italian group of people, and one head of the mafia, whenever he wanted something done, he just called the people together and get it done and stuff. And then this other person here, his name is James Hamilton, and he lived in California, somewhere around Long Beach. I'm not sure exactly where. But when our ship was going to the Pacific, we came down the coast on what they call a sort of a shakedown cruise.
Yeah.
To make sure that everything was working right. And we stopped close to where he lived. And he invited a number of us to go home with him for the day. Mm. And he had a car, because he was about 4 years older than most of us. And he had a car and took us out on a freeway, which we'd never seen one before. stuff like that. Come back home there, and his mother had made some avocado sandwiches for us, which never had
avocado
sandwich before. But like I say, we kept in touch. Like I say, these three of us, we kept in touch pretty much until they started dying.
Yeah,
they're all gone. Why I'm still here, I don't know.
Because the good Lord wants you to be here.
He's got a job for me somewhere, and I told him, here I am.
I think this is part of your job. I think making people aware of what you guys went through. You know, you're representing your entire vessel. You're representing your entire generation, you know, and I've told you this before, but they don't teach a lot of this stuff in school anymore. And I think the good Lord picked you and others that are still here to, you know, help make people aware of what's happening, because I just, you know, a lot of people don't understand that if you didn't sacrifice what you sacrifice, none of us would have what we have right now.
We would get on the ship, we would get paid, I don't know, approximately once a month.
Okay.
I mean, half of my pay and stuff went home to Mom. And she kept every penny of it for me.
Sure.
And the other half I used to buy things I needed from the ship's store. I mean, like Aqua Velva to put on there. Some of the people on the ship were using that Aqua Velva, mm-hmm. to squeeze it through a loaf of bread and drink it. Mm. And then we had one person on the ship, name was Kaczynski from Pennsylvania, and his family would send him a care package periodically, and it'd be some canned goods in there, but one or two of the cans were whiskey, because they canned it themselves. They had a canner,
yeah,
and they'd can that whiskey, and he'd always save the biggest part for himself, but he'd always give us a little taste of it when it came around to that.
How much would you pay? Do you remember?
Well, I started in at $21.
Wow.
And then, I went in, I was actually sworn in before Christmas, of 1943.
Okay.
And at that time, there was a group of people from Fredericksburg that were grown from the same time. And I took one of them home with us to eat and stuff like that. And then they said, well, instead of sending you away before Christmas, we'll swear you in now. And you come back on the 1st of January or 2nd. And then we'll send you off to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we did. And we came to San Diego. We call them boxcars. Because, I mean, there wasn't any bunks or anything to sleep or anything like that. You slept on the wooden benches that were in this stuff here. And I remember we stopped in California someplace in a orange grove, and a couple of the fellas jumped out and went over there and got a lot of oranges and threw them back in and stuff like that. But then I did the boot camp at San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's 3 months that we did there. So January, February, and March. And then when I finished with boot camp, they sent me to radar school, mm-hmm. which was at Point Loma, which is right close in that general sure. vicinity. And I think that was a 6-week course where we learned how to basically operate. There was two types of radars. One was a surface radar, an SG, and then there's this, the, for aircrafts. And there was a big bed screen that was on top of our ship, and it was an SK. And then they also taught us to identify the Japanese ships and also the Japanese planes, the different types, the Bettys, the Zeros.
Based on the radar signatures?
Well, on the set, plus on sight.
Visual.
Yeah, because I didn't realize it, but the lookouts were part of the same group. And so that's why they taught us how to identify the ships, because that's where my battle station was, as a lookout.
I see.
And see them coming in. And so when I graduated from radar school, I was at the top of the class. So I was promoted to from Seaman second class, which is a buck private, to Seaman first class, which is sort of like a corporal.
I see.
And so I think my pay raise jumped up to about $25 from 21.
It's quite a pay raise, percentage-wise.
Yeah.
that's quite a bit. So,
and then
20% raise.
Just like then they put me in charge of the group I think it was about 15 of us that were assigned to the USS Washington. And they physically handed me the papers whatever it was that I was supposed to present to the captain when I got to the ship and have these people report in, and that's what we did. And the ship was in Bremerton, Washington.
I see.
Being overhauled, because what happened out in the Pacific was that the USS Washington and another battleship, which I'm not sure exactly which one it is now, but they had a collision in the fog. And the result was that 58 feet of the bow of the Washington had to be cut off. And so it went into, I think, Ulithi, and they cut it off and put a false bow on it. And it limped all the way back to Bremerton, Washington, with a couple of destroyers protecting it. This was before I got on it.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got to Bremerton, Washington, they had 58 feet of the bow sitting in a dry dock. And they just came in and removed that false bow that they had. And the Washington was sitting there. And so the front 58 feet was welded on. And every time we got into rough weather, they would secure the front 58 feet. We had watertight compartments, and the people that were staying up in that area would have to get away from there, so they were afraid it might crack or
break off
or something. But I talked to a number of people and later, and they said that the wells were probably stronger than the metal itself. And so there wasn't anything to worry about.
What a weld job that must have been.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because the whole ship is in watertight compartments.
Right.
I mean, when we go to general quarters, I mean, everything is all the compartments are closed, so that if there's a ship gets hit, it makes a hole in this particular area. It can't go anywhere else because you got watertight compartments there.
Yeah.
And so
that's, you know, those battleships, I mean, as I look at that thing up there, that picture, the picture you showed me, they're just so well built. They're so strong. And that's probably about the only thing that could really damage it was colliding with another ship, you know?
Yeah. And I'm sure that the kamikazes could have done a good job on us.
Yeah.
But what our job was, and they don't mention it too much in that report there, but our job when we got out to the Pacific was to become part of a convoy, I guess.
Armada.
It was a we were protecting the aircraft carriers.
Right.
Because they'd have these groups of ships where they'd have about four aircraft carriers in the middle, and they'd have two to three battleships around them, and then maybe four or five cruisers, which is the next biggest ship.
Right.
And then about 15 destroyers around. And we would travel we'd zigzag, and everybody was going, supposed to be going the right way when they're changing course and stuff. And they would give signals for changing course with the people on the semaphore, because they didn't want the Japanese to know what we were actually doing. So we had a lot of radio silence back then.
Because it was not secure and the Japanese could intercept the transmissions. When you joined in 1944, you graduated radar. How long was radar school?
6 weeks.
So you had 3 months of 90 days of training, basic training, and then you had radar school, which is another 6 weeks. So you were probably in June or July of
4 and a half. It was January,
May,
February,
I guess.
March, April. It was probably the latter part of May.
Yeah,
that we in effect took off to the Pacific, May of 1944.
From Washington, you met your crew and the captain and everybody, and then the USS Washington was being completed on the overhaul, and then you.
Yeah, we were there maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
Because I can remember going to Seattle, because Bremerton was on one side of the Puget Sound and Seattle was on the other, and they had the Black Ball Ferry line that would take you across there. And like I say, there wasn't anything in Bremerton. It was just a little dinky little town. And so everybody wanted to go to Seattle.
The Emerald City, as they call it.
I guess whatever it was. But we'd go over and we'd practically stay the whole night and come back and report back to the ship before 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
And so we were there. And one of the odd things that people were doing, they were always trying to find a way to bring whiskey onto the ship and stuff. And so they would, some of the sailors would have it taped onto their legs, and because they're wearing blues and stuff.
Right.
And so the shore patrol were getting pretty smart about that. So
they'd when they
come in there, they had their club and they'd bang between your legs to make sure you didn't have a package of whiskey down there or something. And so, but we, like I said, I don't know. We may have stayed there 3 weeks or a month.
Yeah.
And then we shipped out, come down with a shakedown cruise, and then went over to Hawaii, and we were able to have either 1 or 2 days. Mm-hmm. But what they did is they'd give half the ship leave one day, right, the other half the next day. I think we were there maybe 2 or 3 days where we could get off and go. And that's when the Cuba Libras were popular.
Yeah.
The rum and coke.
Yep.
Yeah. The cola.
And but you didn't have any of those, did you?
Oh, no. If you had a uniform on, you didn't have to worry about anything. Except them drinking too much, and I never was, like, say, much of a drinker back then. Anyway, and then from there, we reported to the fleet, and I think it was a 5th fleet. And Bull Halsey, Admiral Halsey, was, I think, in charge of all the battleships then. Because I remember that towards the end of the war, we broke off from the carrier task force and armed a battleship task force and chase the Japanese Navy up around the Sea of Japan and so forth, and never did catch him, but
had him on the run.
Yeah, we had all the way around.
So you first, you went to, when you left Washington, you went on your shakedown, basically to make sure the ship was functioning properly and whatnot down the coast. And then from there, you went to Pearl Harbor for a couple days. And then from there, you went to the Pacific.
And we were on a nice cruise. And the trouble is, you never got off.
Yeah.
I can remember one time we came into, I think it's called a Ulithi
Atoll, which was sort of a floating maintenance center.
Yeah, it was a group of islands, and
right.
It started like in a circle, and
right.
You'd come in there, and you if there's anything you needed fixed on the ship, they'd fix it.
Right,
and you'd take on your provisions, and you'd get fully loaded with your fuel and stuff like that, and they would give us a short time on leave to go to an island called Mog Mog.
Mog Mog.
That was the recreation island.
Interesting.
They gave us two hot beers and a baseball bat and a couple of gloves and a softball and stuff like that to go play. And
just an open island to go.
Yeah, just there wasn't anything else to do. So get over there and drink a couple of beers and walk around and play, and there was nothing else to do. And we'd come back, and that was it. I think we did that. I think at one time it was one of those things where half the ship went over,
yeah,
and then the other half went over. And so I think we had 2 days of recreation there. But that was the only time we ever got off the ship.
And
from the time that we left Bremerton, Washington, until the time we got back to Bremerton, Washington, sometime in June or July of 1945.
That's amazing. How, just out of curiosity, but when they fill those battleships up with fuel, how long will that last before you have to refuel again? Pretty damn long time,
well,
right?
But we were in the Ulithi there.
Yeah.
I guess they just took their time, but it took quite a while. But we would refuel it at sea.
I see.
I mean, just like these airplanes you see refueling in the air. I mean, we'd have a
fueler would come
ship
to you.
Come upside next
tanker.
To us, and we'd have these guns where we'd shoot a rope over there to their ship, or they'd shoot it to us, mm-hmm. and we'd pull these hoses over them.
Put them in.
Put them where they're supposed to go. I never did do that.
Sure, sure.
But they would do that, and you know, probably, you know, hours. I mean, they would be there for, you know, 4 to 6 hours or so, and refueling as they went.
That's so. Your first engagement, probably that you were involved in, was probably the Marianas, right? Was
that? Well, yes. As far as in other words, we did two things. One of the things was we were in these task force to protect the aircraft carriers.
Right.
And we went all around the South Pacific area, and we were just protecting the carriers.
Right.
And the carriers would their planes would take off early in the morning to bomb these different islands there, and the Japanese kamikazes would come in early in the morning.
Yep.
And they would try to get through the destroyers, the cruisers, the battleships to the
carriers.
To the carriers, because they wanted to sink the carriers. If they sink the carriers, then the planes coming back wouldn't have a place to,
right.
to land, and they'd
right.
have to go into the water and stuff. And so, I mean, and so we, like that, I call it the crow's nest, you
right.
know, being up there, we were
the radar
looking. I was on the lookout as far as the battle station is concerned. And we see those kamikazes come right at us, and they'd see that we weren't a carrier, and they'd flip over that way. And I don't think we knocked down more than one or two.
Yeah.
But they would come through, and we could just see the shells. They would have tracers, the lighted ones that would show. And they dadgum bullets would be going all around that dadgum kamikaze and keep coming in until somebody finally get to them. But they'd come in and want to drop that little bomb and hit that carrier. And they did several of them. I don't remember which one, but they,
right.
I know they sunk one or two in these. And we would travel in probably about three of these task forces. There would be maybe three of them in the general area and stuff. And so we'd all be looking out for each other. But they would come in early in the morning or late in the evening at dusk, so you can't see them.
Couldn't see them coming.
And so that's what, when we were on the ship, we'd be getting up at, you know, like 5 o'clock, an hour before dawn,
and right.
be at our battle stations in case they came in. Maybe
right.
they'd come in, maybe they wouldn't. Because I remember one time, they evidently, the command had got word that there was going to be a big raid coming in. And so they fed us steak and everything for breakfast, and because they knew that we were going to be on our battle stations for probably 6 or 8 hours.
Yep. Yep.
And that's where we were. But at that time, they didn't come in.
So you were basically the first, because you were in the crow's nests, you were basically the first notification to the captain that, hey, we've got trouble coming, whether it was radar or visual sighting or what have you.
The radar would catch them first coming someplace, and then we would visually see, and then we'd report it to the
bridge.
The bridge, and they would take over from there.
And so I mean, it was fairly often that these things would happen, right?
Oh,
I mean,
you know, every day almost.
Jeez.
And of course, like I said, you know, hell, we were 18-year-old kids, most
right.
of us. I mean, there was, we had a few, we call them father images,
right.
that were on the ship that they were probably 30 years old, and they had a family back home and stuff like that, and they were the old-timers that had been on the ship from the Atlantic back to the Pacific and stuff. And so we sort of looked up to them, and usually those were the people that were operating the radars at the time of a battle, because
right.
they had the experience and stuff. I mean, I would occasionally on watch, I would operate one of the surface radar or the,
right.
the aircraft radar for maybe an hour.
Right.
And because nothing's going on, if we find something that looks like it's an aircraft coming in or something, I mean, we'd
right.
get the other people to come in and take over and
right.
stuff like that. But so that was our basic operation.
Right.
And then the next operation was to provide support for the Marines that were invading Saipan, Tinian,
Guam,
Iwo Jima, Okinawa, because I mean, on all three or four of those things, I mean, I was up in the crow's nest.
Right.
And we were bombarding.
Yeah.
I mean, Iwo, we could actually see the Marines landing, the dadgum, the ships coming in like that, and their flap
Ramps.
Coming out like that, and the Marines going right onto the beach and stuff. And it was rough. And of course, like I say, J.J. Knopf was one of those.
Yeah.
It was in the Marines that was in the foxholes there at Iwo. But like I say, we were, our problem was to bombard over and try to soften up that damn rock.
Yeah.
But it was a terrible thing, but we bombarded them, I don't know, but at least a couple of days, two or three days that we did that. And we did the same thing for like Saipan, Tinian, and Okinawa.
So you were in your carrier group, and then periodically, anytime there was a big invasion like that, like Saipan and Tinian, Guam, Marianas, then Iwo, then Okinawa, you were called in to support those and bombard there, and then you return. And then you also mentioned, and we were looking at earlier, about the carriers that you were, the carrier groups that you were part of, they were also bombing Tokyo.
Yeah.
You know, they were close enough, I assume, after...
Up to Okinawa.
Yeah, after Okinawa, they were close enough.
Okinawa was really the stepping stone to...
Yeah.
To Japan.
To reach Tokyo.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. And you guys were involved in... I mean, the Washington has a very impressive battle record, if not one of the most impressive battle records for battleships. But you guys were involved in almost every major...
But like I said, you know, you take Iwo Jima, and I think it's JJ and me. I mean, he was sitting in a damn foxhole with a damn gun, just firing away and people firing at him. I was sitting back over here looking at it, and when my watching time was over, I could go down and take a hot shower and...
Right.
And smoke a cigarette and relax a bit. But I mean, hell, he couldn't do anything like that. I could go to the bathroom and I mean, he couldn't. I mean, like I say, I think I was fortunate. And I think we were fortunate in not getting hit. Let's put it that way first. Because I mean, we never, at our age, we never even thought about death.
Right.
I mean, you don't think about I'm going to die or... But you can see these damn kamikazes come by, and when they veer off and stuff, you can see the pilots in there. But like I say, we knew they were after the carriers more so than the
others,
so we felt a lot safer than the people on the carriers.
And you've, I mean, Japan had a powerful Navy and a powerful Air Force, you know, obviously they had a powerful army as well, but that's a lot of pressure to live every single day, you know. But you're right. I read something recently that talked about, in fact, I need to get you a copy of it. It's a really good book. It's called Stories from the Pacific. And I interviewed this gentleman, and he was on Iwo Jima as well. And he talks about extensively in there how war is meant to be fought by the young. Because once you reach a certain age, you're wise to the world. You know, you have biases and you have fears and you have all those things. But when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, you're innocent to the world and you don't have a whole lot of fear, to your point.
Yeah, I guess I never thought about it that way, but that's the way
it works. He said it like that. And we all kind of know that, but we never have said that. And he said it very, made a lot of sense the way that he said it. You know, I'm going to get you a copy of it, or maybe available on audiobook too. And I'll see if it is, because he very articulately stated a lot of the things that, you know.
Well, if you know the name and the author, I can see if they have it at the line.
Well, actually, the Washington, before I got on it, was down in the southern Pacific by Australia and the islands down there,
mm-hmm.
and they were involved in a surface battle with the Japanese Navy
mm-hmm.
down there, and supposedly the Washington was credited with sinking a battleship.
Wow.
Down there, and probably one of the only ones that was sunk by a surface battle.
That's unbelievable. That's quite a ship you were on, with quite a lot of history in tradition. And to think that you were in the location that you were, and you saw everything, you know, that happened on your watch.
I stop and sometimes visualize and start thinking, what are those people down there in the the engine room thinking when all this stuff is going on. If something happens, that's the first thing that's going to get flooded, you know.
Right.
And then the other things, you have these friends on the ship that have 20 millimeter guns, which mm-hmm. an individual would sit there and put them on his shoulder and he'd do by sight.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the 40 millimeter quads
mm-hmm.
that were controlled by radar, and they would shift and shoot by themselves. You know, they weren't hand operated. Right. That could be hand operated, but they were probably, and so they were out on the deck, and these Japanese ships would come in there, could scrape the deck there. And then you have the other people. We had 10 turrets of what we call the 5-inch 38 caliber guns, and there were two of them in each turret, and they had the people in the turrets, and they were having to load those mm-hmm. those guns by hand or put them on the, I forgot how to describe it, but to put it on this little trailer.
Yeah.
They take it right on in. And I think those people were probably worse than I was as far as hearing loss is concerned, yeah. because our hearing loss was just like when we were bombarding Iwo. I mean, they were sitting there with 16-inch guns going, three of them going bang, three more going bang, and three more, and they start up again. And they just go like clockwork like that. And we're sitting up there in the open and hearing all this damn noise that's going on. They don't even give us cotton to put in our ears, or they don't think about anything right. like that. But then I think about these people that were in these turrets, that those guns were going off right there. And how, I wonder, you know, what happened to their eardrums and stuff. And, I just felt that I was very fortunate.
Right.
That I got into the division where I was away from actual firing of the guns and stuff, but it was sort of the intelligence division, I guess,
part of the ship.
And then, even though on my battle station was a lookout, I mean, it gave me a view of what was going on.
Yeah.
That a lot of the people that are down in the engine room never even had a chance to see.
Well, it's stuff you saw and some stuff you probably wish you didn't see, but bottom line is you can picture what it was like, and you actually saw every step of the way, which is pretty amazing. There's maybe nobody else out there that saw a lot of the things that you saw, you know, that's still alive.
Talking about paydays, you know, when we get paid.
Yeah.
And once a month, they would have a couple of big crap games down in the engine room.
Yeah.
Where the officer's not going to go down and
right.
bother them and stuff. And I had this friend that, he was a gambler. I wasn't a gambler.
Yeah.
But he'd take his paycheck down there, get his money, and go down there. Every month it seemed like he'd lose. And he'd come back up and said, Bill, let me $5 or $10. I know I'm going to hit it. Got to. And so I lent him $5. And back with a look on his face.
Lost it.
And then next payday, he pays me back the $5, and then he comes back to bars. But like I said, I never got involved in any of the gambling on the ship, but there was quite a bit of gambling.
Well, it's like a floating city, you know.
It was, really, because we had our own laundry. I mean, take our laundry. I mean, our clothes all had our name in them.
Yeah.
And like I say, the laundry would take divisions. We had different divisions. Ours was all our division.
Yeah.
And they had the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth divisions, and they would get all the people's clothes, and they'd wash them, and then they'd send them back to the general area where they slept, and they'd have some people there just sorting out. You could see the names stenciled on them, and they were just sorting out and throwing them on your bunk. We had a locker that was probably at the most 3x3.
Yeah.
And maybe 3 or 4 feet deep, something like that. And so when I started smoking cigarettes, that's what I would spend my money on. There'd be about three of us would get together, and we'd buy a case of 50 cartons, and we'd just divide that up and or sell some of it to some of the other people, and we'd probably keep about 10 or 15 cartons ourselves for the month, because hell, we were smoking all the time.
Well, everybody did at that time. Everybody did. What would you say is your most memorable moment on ship? What would you say was most memorable battle or most memorable moment?
I guess it's hard to determine. I mean, there are two parts. One was the kamikazes coming in.
Yeah.
You just can't visualize. I mean, it's the sea of them coming in, and they're coming in. And the destroyers over here are trying to knock them down. They get past the destroyers. The cruisers are trying to knock them down. They get past the cruisers. The battleships are trying to knock them down. And if they don't, then there's the aircraft carriers.
They got a
lot of firepower too. But, you know, it's just amazing that you can see those things coming in, and all the shells just bursting all around them, and they're just easing on in like that, and some of them will go down and some of them will come in. But now that was one, and the other would be Iwo Jima, because in Iwo Jima we were out maybe 2 miles or a mile from shore, and we were bombarding. But from my vantage point and my lookout battle station, I could see our ships coming in and unloading and crawling up
on the beach. Thing.
And so, I mean, to me, those were the two most. But there were other little things like when you're traveling all the time. I mean, at night, you're going around like that. And so, I mean, we had a friend, a person in our division there that had his guitar. His name was Tex Bryant. He was from close to Houston, Texas. And we'd get together when we were off our watch stuff there, and we'd sit around and he'd sing songs to us. We'd sing like that. We'd do that and have a, you know, camaraderie and get along real fine. And then the other time I can remember that our ship was so hot that there would be two or three or four of us would grab our mattresses and we'd go up on deck. Mm-hmm. And go under one of those 16-inch turrets, and we sleep until a little before dawn, and then we pack them up and get back in, because we knew we had to get in before general quarters sounded, because we didn't want to get locked out if we ended up being in a deep ship, you know. And so, just some things like that where we'd be out there. And we'd be talking and just watching the smooth ocean and stuff like that, and beautiful scenery and things like that. So, I mean, you know, those are sort of the two things. And, I mean, and seeing the ships operate in a task force with such precision.
Yeah.
That they could go, and all of a sudden they change. But they were always zigzagging. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, at a point, everybody knew that all the ships at the same time would turn.
It's amazing.
And turn. And it was just amazing how everything worked out.
And that concludes part one of our two-part conversation, Mr. Bill Lozano, United States Navy, World War II. And I want to thank Mr. Lozano for sharing this with us. Just an amazing man, amazing story. And you can see all that he saw and experienced on that radar tower on the USS Washington, which was really an amazing battleship. And as I mentioned, it's like a floating city. And one thing that's important to put in perspective, and he mentioned this during his interview, and you know, you don't always think about this, but you think of ships and you think about, you know, you board them, get off for a little while, go back on. But when you're on a battleship, you don't leave, right? We've heard from LST folks and folks, you know, that would constantly get off the ship, pull up to land. Mr. Lozano remembers getting off the ship one time. That was in Ulithia, which is the floating kind of city that we created to maintain the ships, refuel the ships. But other than that, once you're on, you are on until you return to the United States. And that was the case with Mr. Lozano. And so it's kind of unique to put that in perspective. A battleship is not a ship that lands and dismounts troops and those sorts of things. A battleship's job is to be in the seas, fast, strong, powerful, and basically a floating armada to protect whatever it may be, aircraft carrier fleet in this case, or provide ground support for the troops or what have you. So I thought that was very interesting. And you know, as we all learn more about the Navy by talking to these incredible men, I'll try to point out things like that. I do want to mention, and this is not a political podcast, nor will it ever be. I always try to keep politics out of it. But I do want to express my sympathy, concern, and just general disdain for what's happened in Afghanistan these past couple weeks. I want to reach out to anyone who served there. I want to thank you for your service, and I want you to understand that what you did was very, very significant. And as a result of your service and going after those that wish to harm our nation and our way of life, you've kept our nation safe and secure. And for that, you should be very proud. What's happening now is embarrassing. It's difficult to watch. And for those who serve there, I know it's extremely reminiscent of what happened back in Vietnam. And one bright spot in all of this mess, and again, I don't want to go into politics, but one bright spot, I just think it's very important to mention because I was really happy and really thrilled to see this. But I've seen several instances of Vietnam veterans reaching out to veterans of these wars of Afghanistan, reaching out with a helping hand and basically asking them, hey, we saw this, we went through this, it was very difficult, and we want to help however we can. So we're here. If you need us, please talk to us. And I'm speaking specifically there of Gary Hale, who is out of the VFW chapter in Dripping Springs, Texas. And they've done just a phenomenal job of reaching out to these younger veterans. And it makes me very proud. And I'm so incredibly appreciative of those men, because when they returned from Vietnam, not only did they see that kind of stuff happening, but they also dealt with, you know, Americans spitting on them and treating them terribly. And here we are now, many years later, and sort of the same thing is happening over there in Afghanistan. But the American people are responding very differently. And the fact that these Vietnam veterans are standing up and reaching out to those to help those that really need help, and especially when they had no one to turn to, is just amazing. So in any difficult situation, there's a silver lining. And these amazing Vietnam veterans are the silver lining of what's happening right now, because everything else is a complete disaster. And I hope and pray that we'll get this under control, because it's just a mess and it's very embarrassing. So I want to reach out and thank all those who serve there. If there's certainly anything I can do, please reach out to me. But I ultimately want to thank all of them for their service and express my sympathies as to what's happening right now. As always, if you would like to follow Walk Among Heroes, please visit our website, www.walkamongheroes.org. You can send us an email at walkamongheroes@gmail.com. I hear from folks who listen to the podcast every single week, and I want to thank all of you for reaching out. I heard from Brad from Iowa this week, who sent me some very, very nice comments, and he was also mentioning his frustration, what was happening in Afghanistan. I had the opportunity to actually go to Iowa and meet some amazing people, the Paulsons, Barb and Denny, and their son Rob, who reached out to me through the podcast and introduced me to an amazing veteran who will be a future Walk Among Heroes episode. And I just really enjoy hearing from people, and I so enjoy, you know, talking and answering questions and all those things. So feel free to send me a note. Also, if you happen to know any veterans that you think would be good to interview, please, by all means, let me know, and I'd be happy to interview them. It's just an honor. That's how I found many of these amazing men and women. So thank you. Again, email address, walkamongheroes@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/walkamongheroes. Instagram, @ walkamongheroes. YouTube, we have a lot of stories on YouTube, a lot of videos that are unedited videos of these interviews and other interviews, if you'd like to check any of them out. As always, we want to thank all those who protect our way of life every single day, the police, the firefighters, the doctors, nurses, all those folks who are out there protecting our way of life. Thank you for all that you do. And we always want to thank our incredible military. We want to thank the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Space Force, everybody out there for protecting our way of life. We support an organization called Wish for Our Heroes. It's www.wishforourheroes.org is our website. Wish for Our Heroes assists military families with basic needs, things like food, shelter, transportation, child needs, medical expenses, other things like that. If you're interested and like to make a donation or volunteer or learn more about them, their website's www.wishforourheroes.org. Until next time, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting our incredible men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world. We hope you enjoyed this week's Walk Among Heroes episode. Be safe, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.